Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. His name is Paul Wilmot, and if you are remotely interested in anything having to do with quantitative finance, then this is the podcast for you. He is not only a colleague and peer of such esteemed quants as Emmanuel Derman and Nassim Taleb, who is really more of a pure mathematician, but he is the purveyor of the world's largest website on quantitative finance. He has written numerous books on textbooks on quantitative finance. He has helped create the certificate for finance quant work, and he has just been absolutely on the forefront of identifying what's wrong with financial models, markets, derivatives, risk-taking. There are few people who understood why the financial crisis of 08-09 was coming, more specifically and earlier than he did. 8 years in advance, he was warning, hey, these models are really problematic, and they're going to result in big problems. They're going to result in real issues, and he turned out to be not only right generally, but what he was criticizing specifically turned out to be a large part of why markets and credit went through its collapse. So with no further ado, here is my conversation with Paul Wilmot. I have an extra special guest. His name is Paul Wilmot. How do I describe him? He is an expert in quantitative finance, a researcher, an author, a consultant, a professor. He has written over 100 research papers on mathematics and finance, several best-selling and some would say groundbreaking textbooks. He runs what is the biggest quantitative analysis website in the world. No lesser a critic than Nassim Taleb described him as the smartest quant in the world, the only one who truly understands what's going on, who uses his head and has a sense of ethics. Paul Wilmot, welcome to Bloomberg.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. I have to correct you.
Okay.
Already I have to correct you. I'm not and never have been a professor. I'm a mere doctor, I'm afraid.
Weren't you a lecturer?
I've had all sorts of research positions in universities, but never reached that exalted...
I'll tell you why I drew that conclusion. There is a YouTube video of you describing some of the chapters of some of your textbooks, and you just have a natural professorial air.
I have this thing, don't I?
And I drew the assumption that I perhaps should not have drawn. So let's talk a little bit about your research, your work, your writing. I have to start out with a quote of yours from one of your papers. The paper published in 2000 was The Use, Misuse, and Abuse of Mathematics and Finance. That title alone is a good place to start. But here's the quote that was so prescient. It's clear that a major rethink is desperately required if the world is to avoid a mathematician-led market meltdown. That is pretty much dead on. And 7 years later, we had the quant crash. And a year after that, we had the full-blown great financial crisis. What were you looking at that gave you such a clear understanding of the coming storm?
Well, I also, a few years after that, I wrote that. I did specify that I thought it was going to be credit derivatives that might be the problem.
So even more specific.
Yes, and that's because of my background. I haven't taken the classical quant route. And I come with a lot of skepticism, and I'm not a great fan of following the herd. So whenever I look at mathematical models, I can pretty much tell you whether they're based on any reality or maybe whether there's any dangers involved with the, you know, the hedging or the valuation. And everywhere I looked, I just saw there were dangers. It was not so, the models for equities are not too bad in quantitative finance. The models for interest rates are pretty bad, except interest rates don't really do much, certainly not at the moment anyway. But credit, the models are not only the models really, really bad in terms of not matching reality and how they're used, but also credit markets are absolutely enormous.
Tremendous. In fact, the also from the same paper, the underlying assumptions of financial models, such as the importance of normal distribution, the elimination of risk, measurable correlations, etc., are all incorrect.
Yes.
And when I read that, I was reminded of the famous George Box quote, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And I know that's sort of a bastardization of what he really was intended, but the natural next question is, are all models wrong, and how can you tell the ones that are useful from the ones that are dangerous?
Well, models in finance are going to be wrong. And it's
by definition, you can't perfectly understand what's happening.
Not at all. And as for the word useful, I think you have to ask what is meant by useful. And there are various ways of looking at this. Useful, are they useful in helping you control risk? Are they helpful in allowing you to do more business? There are all sorts of different angles. And some of these are sort of conflict with what the man in the street might want. For example, a model might be useful because it's great for marketing and it, you know, it fools the regulators and it's not very good, but hey, it's useful if you're going to try and start a really big hedge fund. So it depends what you mean.
I don't think that's what Professor Box was referring
to.
However, they certainly have can serve useful purposes, albeit perhaps not accurately predicting what the universe may look like.
Exactly. So you'd hope that when we talk about having a model that's useful, you'd like to think in terms of, oh, it allows us to manage our risk or hedge our risk, something like that, or produce important new products that are helpful in, you know, hedging your business or whatever. But I'm a bit too cynical to think of.
So you said you didn't take the usual route into quantitative finance. What was your route? How did you find your way into quant finance? And how does that differ from the typical quant on Wall Street?
Well, you have to go back to my childhood, really. I've always, from a very young age, run my own businesses of various sizes. And even when I was a mathematician at university doing my doctorate or doing postdoctoral work, I was always interacting with the real world, trying to do consultancy, etc. And it meant that I saw a lot of different problems from fields outside of finance. In fact, when I started in finance in the late 80s, before that, I didn't even know there was any mathematics in finance, but I'd work for aeronautical companies, for steel companies, for all sorts of different businesses where you try and take a physical problem and turn it into something mathematical. Mm-hmm. And then a colleague introduced me to these things called options. This was in the, it was actually just before the 87 crash. And just looking into the literature, I found, hey, there's real mathematics involved in derivatives. And so I started just to apply the same principles of mathematical modeling to derivatives as I had to all these other real-world physical processes that I'd worked on. Actually, when I first saw the famous Black-Scholes equation, I thought, this is great. This is just like second-year undergraduate mathematics. these days, apparently, you're supposed to have a PhD, but actually, that's a load of nonsense. Most quant finance is just second-year undergraduate maths.
Some of the book is really quite fascinating. You start out with a history of investment theory, and I thought skipping from the South Sea bubble to Adam Smith to the efficient market hypothesis, what is the connective tissue between all three of those major events in the history of finance?
Well, what you start to see is going from just people's personal experience through to trying to lay down some principles and then trying to quantify those principles. Mm-hmm. So we're up to the period now, the modern era, when pretty much everything in finance is all quantified. Everything's all in terms of expected returns and volatility and quantities like that.
It could be reduced to mathematical models.
Everything's become mathematics, yes.
Right. So then I always thought of the random walk theory as a sort of squishy psychological claim that, hey, you know, maybe some people can beat the market, but you're probably not one of them and you probably can't pick them. And then once we bring in taxes and costs and everything else, you're better off just indexing. But you relate the whole concept of random walk to probability theory. What ties these two together?
Well, if you go back to the different types of analysis that people do in finance, you've got fundamental analysis, which is about trying to figure out by looking at the company's reports and the directors, etc., the products, how much is this company really worth? Now, that's very difficult to do. That's a lot of analysis is required. Can you read balance sheets? I can't read balance sheets.
No, not without falling asleep halfway through.
Exactly. So, but the real problem is that you're not trying to predict what the market value of a company should be, because you're trying to predict what other people, the people who are buying selling shares, think.
Keynes' famous beauty contest.
Exactly. So you move on to fundamental. Move on from fundamental to technical analysis, which is exact opposite, which is really easy. You draw a chart, do some trend lines and some patterns. Problem is, that sort of thing, statistically speaking, doesn't work. I mean, the scientific evidence suggests that the vast majority of that doesn't work. So the great breakthrough of the 50s, 60s, 70s was to say, let's throw all that away. Let's just say, you know, we can't predict things. We've got the concept of the efficient market hypothesis as a sort of background for this, but let's just say it's like tossing a coin. Now, is it tossing a biased coin? What's the chance of heads? What's the chance of tails? So you put numbers to these probabilities. And from that, we get lots of theories about derivatives valuation. And once you've got derivatives, you can value derivatives, you can create new instruments, and the new instruments might require new mathematics. So you have this snowballing effect where you've got the mathematics increasing and the number and type of products simultaneously increasing.
So there's a quote in the book I really like, and I'm going to mangle this a little bit. No investment strategy based on mainstream finance theory can protect investors from market-wide crashes. First, is anyone really suggesting, hey, our strategy is going to protect you? Is that, I guess that's naive of me to ask, but do people really believe, oh, here's the magic 1987-like portfolio insurance that will protect us?
I'm sure there are some things you can do. There are all sorts of nuances here. I remember Nassim, my dear pal, Nassim Taleb, telling me about the way he pitches this idea. And that is to say, it's insurance. Mm-hmm. It's not a portfolio, it's not an investment, it's insurance. You're going to lose money. In fact, you hope you'll lose money, because if you make money on this insurance, it's because your house is burnt down, right, which you don't want to have happen. So that's quite a psychological way of looking at this, putting in place the protection as a cost rather as an investment. There are some things you can do. Of course, the famous portfolio dynamic portfolio insurance of the 80s was a classic example of a feedback effect, a positive feedback effect, that the very action of trying to protect your portfolio is what caused
made it worse,
which is a beautiful concept.
What I don't understand is, who thought, oh, if the market is crashing, I'll go out and buy some puts and that'll protect me? Summing it up that way, how did anybody think that that model was valid? And granted, there's a little hindsight bias here, but still, right, it sounds so obvious after the fact that that would not work.
Right. I don't know. I think in all of this, that a key thing you've always got to remember is that the psychology of the markets, and that the whatever the mathematical models say, somehow human beings in this particular field do manage to mess up the models.
So here's another mangled quote. Bankers offering complex financial products don't always understand the risks, and that when a bank goes bust, stock markets collapse, house prices tumble, it's your bank account, your shares, and your home equity that suffers.
Right. Well, it's certainly true in my experience that bankers and especially regulators, I have to say, do not know as much as they ought to. If they were doctors and they didn't know, you know,
which some leeches do a little bleeding,
exactly,
we're all good.
Or, you know, which side is the heart on, you know, that sort of thing, then there'd be lawsuits flying. But bankers, in my experience, there's a lot of herd mentality within bankers, and that works for them. That's how they make money, is from pretending there are no risks, and you know, although they may, deep down, they may realize there are risks. And regulators, I haven't met that many regulators. I don't seem to bump into them very often, maybe because of the things I've said about them in the past. But my experience is often they're very good at book learning. You know, they've read the maths books, they know the models, but they're sorely lacking in street smarts, in my experience. So they don't really understand how the world works.
So you have in the past suggested a solution to the problem of both bankers that don't understand risk and regulators that don't know how to regulate it, is a Tobin tax on each transaction, a 0.008% tax on any buy, sell, any trade whatsoever. And how would that work, and how would that protect markets?
You're very good with your numbers. The idea of the Tobin tax is to stop very high-frequency trading, because you then lose the high frequency. One of the problems with high frequency trading is that you lose the connection between the value of a share company and the price. It just becomes about, you know, some time series of numbers, and it could be anything. It doesn't matter. But there's a company here, and there are people whose jobs are on the line.
Let's talk a little bit about the time you spent at Caixa Capital. Two people separated by a common language. So you were a founding partner of the Volatility Arbitrage Hedge Fund, which was running about $200
million. It's just under $200 million, yes.
And so tell us a little bit about volatility arbitrage, which is sort of ironic in these days of almost no volatility.
It's interesting that it's very difficult, I have found, to predict the direction a stock is going to go, up or down. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be easier, and there are statistical reasons for this, actually, but it seems to be easier to forecast volatility, how much noise there is in a stock.
Huh.
So you predict,
sort of counterintuitive, though, that you it's harder to find the signal and it's easier to find the noise.
Yes, I can see that. But at the same time, you can see what the market is sort of thinking volatility is, because options, the valuation of options, hinges upon estimation of volatility. So you can say, oh, here's a call option. What volatility are they plugging into the famous Black-Scholes formula to give that price that you see in the market? And so you can back out a thing called implied volatility, which is sort of a bit like what the market thinks. So you look around for when is the implied volatility different, or sufficiently different from your forecast volatility? And if they're different, and if you just happen to be right, then you can make some money.
Mm-hmm.
So that
sounds complex.
It's the purest sort of volatility arbitrage. Mm-hmm. I'm betting my forecasts against the market's forecasts, essentially, is what it amounts to.
So a not-so-efficient market.
Not so efficient. Now, I don't think anyone believes in efficient markets who's listening to this program, do they?
I think there are a decent number. It's a really interesting point, because I think there are a number of people who say, look, Cliff Asness, who runs AQR, Gene Fama was his PhD dissertation advisor.
Yeah.
And to Fama's credit, he said, hey, if you want to go out and prove factors work, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we know the market is kind of, sort of, mostly, eventually efficient. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Not necessarily. It depends whether there's any mechanism for removing any efficiency. People just say, oh, you know, people say things like the market's always right.
Well, we know that's certainly not. How could the market be 23% lower the day after the crash? Was it right the day before? Was it right the day after? Is it wrong both times? It's kind of hard to say the market is always right.
Right. Well, an example I sometimes give my students is about, uses the idea of car insurance. Mm-hmm. For example, suppose you've got a $20,000 car and your annual car insurance is, let's use simple numbers, $1,000. A quant would say, oh, it's a $20,000 car, it's a $1,000 car insurance. Oh, that means there must be a 5% chance of crashing. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're missing out from that 5%, the fact that the insurance company needs to make a profit and they're doing things on average, all sorts of things. So the way your typical quant or Chicago finance professor looks at things is in a very pure way that sort of misses all the fun. What I think of, and as I've said before, I've been running businesses since I was a child, virtually, and the business side of things is what makes things interesting. And so when we approach this, sort of going back to volatility arbitrage, you'd be amazed at, if you looked at the literature, there must be tens of thousands of papers which talk about how to back out from market prices what the implied volatility is, and how they assume that the implied volatility is right, that the market knows, the market has a crystal ball, it knows what volatility is going to be. Mm-hmm. Must be tens of thousands. How many papers are there which say, well, you know what if the market is wrong and the volatility, the real volatility, is different from implied volatility? How can you make money?
The underlying strategy. That's what, my strategy. CASA capital.
CASA capital. There must be half a dozen papers. And surely that's the most important thing. You've got an option. The question is, what am I going to do with this? I could hedge with it or I could make money from it. Mm-hmm. And there's just half a dozen papers on how to make money.
So how did the hedge fund do?
The hedge fund did wonderfully for its lifespan of 3 years, which I believe is the average lifespan of a hedge fund.
And so at the end of the 3 years, you basically tapped out and said, I'm going to go back to writing.
I learned a lot from that hedge fund. A lot of things about, not just about hedge funds, but also about myself.
Oh, really?
I found that very interesting. Because the hedge fund was based in New York.
And where were you located?
I was located
time?
In London. So there was this 5-hour time difference. And just as things were getting interesting in New York was when I was sitting down to dinner or wanting to go to bed or something like that. So that was kind of frustrating.
Let's talk about the Wilmot business model. So you run the website. Yeah. You have a print magazine.
Yeah.
You have a Paul and Dominic quant recruitment, the book, which we all know is books are giant moneymakers. What is your business model as quant expert?
Well, the Paul and Dominic's doesn't exist anymore.
That's
closed
gone.
Down a few,
okay.
Yes. But also there was the, we talk about the world's largest quant website. It's also apparently the world's most expensive magazine, I've been told. I don't know whether that's true or not.
What's the magazine cost?
It's about $600 for six issues.
I don't think that's terribly expensive.
I looked it up. It's not actually.
If you look at some of the medical journals and stuff, these are thousands of. In fact, there was a big article not too long ago about what used to be academic research now sells for thousands of dollars, and there's two companies that have sucked up all these. Yeah. Formerly free publication.
And that was a quote from Esquire magazine, so I'd just like to repeat that. It's not very useful in marketing, though. There was until recently, well, there still is, the Certificate in Quantitative Finance.
Yep.
That is the world's largest high-level quant education firm with a company called Seven City. This CQF was founded with a company called Seven City Learning in 2003, was it?
Mm-hmm.
But it was sold up to Fitch about 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh, really?
So, but what is the business model? The business model, well, my whole business model all my life has been do something which is fun, and then I accidentally, or I always have this urge to turn things into businesses. It's not a greed thing, it's an enthusiasm thing. It's almost like I've got some hobby, I'd like to make it public.
It becomes more long-lasting and sustainable if there's a revenue stream behind it.
Yeah, I don't think of it like that.
No?
It's just sort of, it's something in my DNA that says, for example, I've started to learn the ukulele a few years ago, and I just know sometime in my life there will be a time when I'm on a stage and people are paying money to listen to me play the ukulele.
I'm going to take the other side of that trade. You should hedge that bet because I don't see that happening.
No, yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm getting there.
No, it's not. It has nothing to do with your skill set. It has to do with the demand for live ukulele performances.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
I would be surprised.
It is the instrument. All the schools are taking up ukulele because it's
I'm on the other side of that trade also.
No. What did you learn at school?
Trombone and piano. Wow.
I wanted to do the trombone, but they wouldn't
let me. The trombone.
Okay.
Because at least the piano, there's a distinct key for each note. The trombone, as a 10-year-old, you have to have an ear to know when you're more or less... And I had a pretty good ear, but not that good.
But they at schools in the UK, at least, they traditionally you learn the recorder, you know, three by three.
Oh, we all did that.
Okay,
that's a given.
But now the ukulele is replacing the recorder because because it's easier. You know, you can play.
Okay,
really, 10 minutes. I should have brought it my ukulele.
I'm sorry you didn't. That would have been great.
Next time. What are we getting onto this?
So business models. Right. You're gonna monetize ukulele performance.
So, but I've always been like that, and so. Going back to the late 80s, I was doing some research with colleagues at university, and we thought, why don't we give some courses on teach people in the city? And they just were phenomenally successful.
Really?
And so we set up a business, and then we turned it into a book, and it was suggested, why don't we self-publish this book? So rather than just hand the book over to a publisher, we actually... published it and printed it, etc. And my mother and my stepfather were in charge of sales. So my poor mother, we put in the advertising, we'd say 24-hour fax hotline. So her phone would be ringing.
How did the book sell?
Oh, it incredibly well. It was just unbelievable. Considering we did hardly any advertising, this is before Amazon, it did it incredibly well by word of mouth. I mean, even before the book came out, people were talking about it. I think people were paying something like $250 for a hard copy that you had to cut and paste the pictures into the text. And I don't mean cut and paste like you do, you know, with a mouse.
I mean physically?
Scissors and glue. So they would get two piles. They get without the images, and then a separate pile with the images. And they pay $250 to stick the two together.
And this was on quantitative finance?
Quantitative finance, yeah.
And this was way early in the rise of the quants.
This was 92 or thereabouts.
Okay, so there were a few, third, fourth inning, you know.
There were a few books out there, but this one was a different style of book. And then from then it turned into software companies. More publishing, etc.
And just sort of were you selling this in the UK, in the US, worldwide?
Worldwide, yeah. My mother and the fax machine. Yeah.
Seriously. Worldwide. And it did very well.
We would give courses down in Wall Street, and we would bring over from the UK boxes full of these books to sell to people on the courses.
It was and you'd wild. Sell them all out every time.
Yeah.
That's pretty fascinating. Do you still self-publish? Because you have a number of books. To your credit, this is Wiley, but what the money formula? But the other quantitative finance books are you self-publishing?
Well, as you mentioned earlier or hinted earlier, you don't make a lot of money usually from books, unless you're J.K. Rowling or someone. So there came a point where there are other things that were more profitable, more successful, and the books became more of a hobby or a publicity marketing tool, really.
Are financial models making people overconfident and reckless in how they behave in the market?
Well, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I certainly heard that actually the accidents involving pedestrians and cyclists have gone up for exactly the same. Because people feel safe in their car and they've got all these cushions and whatnot, they're less likely to be injured, but people drive faster and so they kill more pedestrians. So
my assumption is they're texting when they're hitting bicyclists.
But
the pedestrians are playing with their phones.
No, it could be. Oh, pedestrians, aren't they awful?
Depends. It's subjective. When you're driving a car, they're awful. And when you're a pedestrian, look at these crazy drivers.
Cyclists, though. What about cyclists?
In Manhattan, horrifying.
Yeah. You can cut all that out. We get into trouble.
No, that's great stuff.
What you should do, of course, is just stick knives in the steering wheel. You get rid of all that, and then you drive very, very safely, I suspect.
Not unless, then we just get a metal... thing over your chest, and
that's true. What can you do?
It's and you'd have to make sure it doesn't pop up and catch you. And
but going back to regulators don't understand. There's a story I could tell, but it's far too technical. But there's some practice that people do in banks called calibration. You don't need to know what it is, but it's something that superficially it looks like it's a good mathematical model, but what it actually does is it hides risk. It makes it any model risk that's there gets hidden by this act of calibration. And when I've spoken to regulators, they don't really understand that what these people who are calibrating are doing is hiding risk. Instead, they go round telling banks, you must calibrate, which is like saying you must hide risk, which is really not what regulators are supposed to be doing.
So let's talk about your wish list when it comes to better regulations, better education, and I believe in the book you call it negative bonuses. So
yeah,
what would your wish list be?
Well, obviously, more people should go to prison. People should have bonuses.
How about some people should go?
Some, that's a start.
Right.
The bonus is taken away, but lots of people get paid stupid money. I think CEOs of companies get paid stupid money.
Especially in the United States.
Just because they went to the same school as some other CEO. That's pretty dodgy.
A number of people have blamed the compensation consultants for using 75% as their frame of reference. Oh, let's compare it to the 75th percentile of other CEOs.
Right.
Why? Why are you assuming you're better than most of the other CEOs out there?
Yeah.
So you have this horrible upward spiral.
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. But also...
For them, but for the rest of us.
Yeah. In the book, we talk about having something like the FAA, who regulate planes. Something like that for banking and complex financial products. The analogy is that whenever you have a new plane, it has to be tested, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you have a new financial product, it should be tested by some people. You can't have too many of this specific. You can't have too much concentration risk, just like you can't have too many planes landing at the same airport at the same time. So there are all sorts of analogies we draw between the airline business and the world of banking. And, of course, it's an international thing. Planes take off one country, land another country. Well, how hard can it be to have an international perspective to the banking regulation?
And I have to ask, since you brought it up earlier, what motivated you and Professor Emmanuel Derman at Columbia and formerly of Goldman Sachs to write the Financial Modeler's Manifesto?
Well, he and I both had pretty much the same... thought at the same time about, and we've both been very skeptical about mathematical models. There's one subtle difference, though, and that is Emmanuel Derman has his name attached to one, which means he's kind of got a bit of skin in the game there, which
right.
I haven't got. So I can be slightly more, than he can, if you catch my drift. Anyway,
yes.
But both of us are very skeptical about the what quants do and risk managers in banks and hedge funds. And it was shortly after the crisis that we both had apparently independently thought we should write something, which is, and we teamed up, and it was a combination of Karl Marx and the Hippocratic Oath that we got our inspiration from.
First, do no harm.
Yes.
We have been speaking with Paul Wilmot. He is a expert in quantitative finance. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Check out my daily column on bloombergview.com. You could follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at bloomberglive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Welcome to the podcast. Paul, thank you so much for doing this. I've been looking forward to having this conversation. I wish I can keep you for another couple of hours, but I have to get to at least two questions before I jump to my standard questions. This is from the book. The notional value of derivatives in 2010 was $1.2 quadrillion. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are we still in any sort of risk from a blow up in derivatives? My assumption is most of that 1.2 quadrillion offsets itself. What is the actual amount that has us at any sort of risk?
It's hard to tell because, yes, there is notional. So it could be that you might have, that could be 1.2 million, quadrillion in swaps. So it mm-hmm. might just be 1% of that is at risk.
Which is still not nothing. 1% of a quadrillion.
However you calculate it, it's too large because it's, that 1.2 quadrillion, even if you take off a zero or two, you're still left with something which is
trillions,
which is, and the world, the GDP of the world is something like 50 trillion. So it's the wrong way around. It's almost like finance is supposed to be a service industry, but it's almost like people are making chairs and tables and whatever just to keep the finance industry going because the numbers.
The tail is wagging
exactly,
the dog.
Exactly.
1% is what, 120 billion? Is that what we're talking about off of 1.2 quadrillion?
12 trillion.
12 trillion?
Yes, yes. And, yeah, so that's still a quarter of the world's GDP, even if you take off two zeros.
The numbers are just mind-boggling.
Yes.
There are all these, since you were running a volatility hedge fund, one of the questions I forgot to ask you before, there are currently all these short volatility products out there. What are your thoughts on these?
Well, in our experience, it was definitely the case that options tended to be overpriced. So in terms of a strategy, you would be selling vanilla options because they're overpriced. But the problem with selling options is when you have some extreme event, then you just blow up.
Right.
So you need to make sure that you've got plenty of tail protection in case that happens, which is something that we specialized in.
And that's why you're friends with Nassim Taleb.
Indeed. Oh, we go way back.
I recall having a lunch with him. It was just three of us in the middle of the financial crisis. It had to be the summer of 08 before AIG and Lehman blew up.
Yeah.
And we were I can't even tell you the restaurant, Kalari Taverna on 44th Street. Normally, you have to make reservations a week in advance. We walk in at 1 o'clock. It's empty. We sit right down. The three of us were just laughing away. I don't have to tell you, he's incredibly entertaining. And we were talking about specifically how parts of this were so obvious coming down the pike. And no, it's not that people didn't see it. Nobody wanted to believe it.
Yeah.
It was quite astonishing.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's a very interesting person. You have to be careful when you're around him because dramatic things always happen.
Yes.
Always.
He's a magnet.
He'll be getting some text messages which will tell about like some astronomical sales of his books or some deal he's involved in or the markets are doing something crazy. I was with him September the 11th.
Yeah, oh, really?
By Liverpool Street Station when we got the phone call saying what happened. I was with him, I think it was July the 7th, in London a few years later when we had four bombs mm-hmm. went off. We were giving a course that day. And things happen, you know,
around him.
With Nassim,
yeah. It makes sense that he wrote The Black Swan because he is a black swan.
Yes, indeed he is.
So
it's ironic, at the same time his book came out, the film The Black Swan came out. So if you Google
unrelated,
black,
right.
Completely.
So let's get to some of our favorite questions that we ask all of our guests. Tell me the most important thing people don't know about your background.
I think I've never had a job.
Is that true?
Well, not really. Well, I had a job when I was 17 for 3 weeks.
Wait, I know. You had a job. You were a professional juggler.
Oh, now you see. Well, I didn't have a boss. What I mean is I've never really had a boss.
Mm-hmm.
I've been running business since I was about 9 years old, including the juggling.
Which is on the bio on your website. I saw that and I'm like, this has to be a typo. Professional juggler,
yeah.
Undercover investigator.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
First man in the UK to obtain an online divorce.
That's correct. Yes.
These are rather unusual curriculum vitae details.
It's because I'm very bad at taking risks physically. I don't take any physical risks.
Okay.
I don't take many financial risks, but I'm happy to take any number of reputational risks you can throw at me. So, that, for example. 2 years ago, and a friend of mine who works for Channel 4, a TV channel mm-hmm. in the UK, he said he wanted to do some investigative undercover thing to find out, were the political parties in the UK corrupt?
Mm-hmm.
If you offered them money, how far could you get? Now, previously, you would have someone pretend to be someone. And they said they wanted to go a step further. In this age of Google, they want to have someone who was real. A real business person who didn't mind making himself look stupid.
Right.
And so he thought of me. And so for 6 months, I had to have meetings with all sorts of politicians of the main parties in the UK.
And offer them money.
And offer them money and try and see what would happen, how far I could go, all without entrapping them. So that, you know, and all often.
Aren't you at risk for committing a crime in the United States, offering an elected official cash to do your bidding is a felony?
Well, there are nuances here, indeed. Uh-huh. And they had teams of lawyers. Because it was a TV program rather than a newspaper, the TV channels have very strict rules. So, for example, we couldn't do... I ended up doing lots of hidden camera stuff.
Uh-huh.
But you're not allowed to do that for TV unless you've got grounds. So we did a lot of preparatory stuff, and we got some sort of dodgy things, which fortunately never got recorded. And then I went in with the equipment on, the pen in the pocket, the thing in the
Did you catch anybody?
Yeah. There was somebody had to resign from the Lib Dem party, and
funny.
It was great fun. Coming to the House of Lords with hidden cameras. How do you smuggle hidden cameras into the government?
Well,
buildings?
Now you have go through a metal detector and exactly. Everything else. It's harder to do that.
Exactly.
All right, so. You've never had a boss is the thing most people don't know about you, but no. But I like the special investigator. Let's talk a little about some of your mentors. Who are the people who helped guide your career along?
Well, I guess the obvious one, my mother.
Right.
My mother, she always encouraged me to, this explains the undercover thing, encouraged me to do things even though they might have frightened me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, with the caveat, nothing physical. I always got out of games at school.
Just reputational risk.
Anything. I'm going to draw the line at singing in public, though.
Okay. So no karaoke.
No. Not, yeah.
I'm with you on that one.
But not the karaoke. So I found that that's very helpful. That if something frightens me, I think, yeah, I've got to do it now. It's frightening me, so I've got to do it.
That's a good philosophy to have.
I think so. And this is way before that book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. Way mm-hmm. before, you know, decades before that.
I'm unfamiliar with that.
You don't know the book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway?
No.
Oh, okay.
Never heard of it.
It's some self-help book from the 80s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, my tutor and supervisor, John Ockenden, I was very lucky when I was studying mathematics to fall in with a group of people, mathematicians who liked solving real world problems, physical problems, for example, using fluid mechanics or mm-hmm. things like that. Because most mathematicians are quite snobbish about their mathematics, and there's a hierarchy amongst mathematicians, which is at the very highest are the people who work on these very profound, deep problems, Fermat's
theoretical,
theoretical things that, you know, to the man in the street, no idea what they're on about or what the relevance is. And really tough things. Tough, you know. Then you move down the ranks and pure mathematicians who work in the abstract. Then you've got applied mathematicians,
uh-huh.
and this group of people were pretty much the lowest of the low in the sense of the hierarchy. In that
really?
They use the maths to solve real problems.
Are they thinking?
Exactly. But it was great fun, and it means that there are very few people. Actually, I can only think of one other person in the world who's had such a breadth of mathematical experience as I have. That's why I can be very, you know, skeptical about the models, because I've seen so much of the mathematical world that other people haven't seen. And of course, when I started working in finance, they had to develop a whole new category, even lower than the lowest of the low, for people working in mathematical finance.
So I have to ask, who is the other person who has a similar breadth of mathematical experience?
Pat Hagen.
Oh, really?
Pat Hagen. He's worked on a lot of volatility stuff. He's a very clever guy. Yeah. But he's had a boss many times.
Ah, so he doesn't have the answer to that question. What investors have influenced you? Who's affected your approach to looking at markets?
Which investors? I don't really follow people in that sense.
That's
I'm
a
afraid.
Good answer. Everybody else says Warren Buffett, but not following people is an even better answer.
I have this talent, which is if people say one thing, I say the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes a point where I don't really know what my own opinion is.
You're just fading the group.
I just annoys people, winds them up, gets me into a lot of trouble.
That.
But it sort of works.
Divergent opinion is a thing. Variant perception absolutely works. Let's talk about everybody's favorite question.
Yes.
Books. What are some of your favorite books? Finance, fact, fiction or nonfiction? Finance, non-finance?
I almost never, never ever read nonfiction. Almost never.
You only read fiction?
I pretty much only ever read
fiction.
See,
I love nonfiction I love fiction and I never get to it.
Oh, okay.
So most of what I read is nonfiction.
I find that the most of the nonfiction that I try to read is sort of obvious. And I think I feel I should subscribe to one of these things where they condense a 500-page book into 2 pages.
So history, biography?
Some biographies, but the Not
give us a few times. What do you like? So if you prefer fiction,
I'd say one of my all-time favorite books is the Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman.
Okay.
Lawrence Stern.
Mm-hmm.
Mid 18th century, I think it was. It's a totally, I can't even begin to describe it. It's been described as an unfilmable book, because it's so, I can't even begin to describe it. You should read it. Have you read it?
Okay, I have not.
It's a fantastic book. But I tend to alternate.
Fiction.
I tend to alternate between, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy. He's fictional. Tristram Shandy.
Okay.
I tend to alternate between what you might call a classic book and then something just to recover from the classic book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now very impatient with books. Up until the age of 30, I would say that if I started a book, I had to finish it. And
you get over that pretty quickly.
It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, other than the birth of my children,
right,
was to realize that I could just stop reading a book.
Put it away. Oh, this is exactly. Disappointing.
So if a book's more than, say, 400 pages, I probably won't even buy it.
Uh-huh.
If it gets rave reviews on Amazon, if it's kind of classical, then I might avoid it because I know it's critiques mm-hmm. are a bit funny. And I'll alternate between maybe some classic and something easy. One thing I've discovered relatively recently is Lee Child. Now, you know Lee Child.
Sure. Jack Reacher or...
Exactly, but the fascinating thing about
My wife plows through those books.
The fascinating thing is... Of all the kind of, it's not exactly pulp fiction, but it's heading that direction. He's the only one that middle-class people will admit to reading.
Oh, really?
Yes.
The funny thing is, if you've seen the movie, it's a short white guy, but in the book, it's a tall black guy. I don't know why they didn't cast that.
He's not black. He's tall. No, he's not. I don't think he's black.
I thought he was.
I don't know. How many have you read?
One.
Okay.
My wife's read 10.
Okay. Well, we should call her.
I'll have to ask. I could be wrong.
But we can definitely agree that Tom Cruise is a short white guy.
For sure, to say the least.
Yeah.
One other book. Give me one other thing you've read recently.
Something I've read. Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
And enjoyed.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No. Or you don't have to have enjoyed.
I mentioned earlier J.K. Rowling.
Uh huh.
She wrote this. So
a pseudonym, the book.
Which one?
I don't remember, but...
She's done this one called The Cuckoo's Calling, something uh-huh. like that. It's awful. I mean, really.
Oh,
I mean, really.
Really.
I love the Harry Potter books.
Uh-huh.
Love them. But this is dire. It's like she's trying to be Agatha Christie, but it's like three times as long as it should be. And you just don't... I finished that just because who done it? But by the time you get to the end, you realize... Anybody could have done it, and she just picked randomly. So you just didn't. It was rubbish.
Don't read it.
No, please.
All right, I'm gonna cross that off my list. So since you first started following quantitative finance, what's changed in the industry? What do you think is the the rise of technology? Is it the wholesale adoption? What is the big shift in quantitative finance?
Well, technology. You have to mention technology, indeed. But that's happened everywhere, not just in quantitative finance, but also the number of people, the sheer quantities of people. And
it's taken over finance pretty much.
It has. And I'm not sure that the people are necessarily as good as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's my sense.
Diluting the talent pool just through sheer numbers or the wrong people being attracted to it?
It's a bit of both. And also education. I have my own educational program, the Certificate in Quantitative Finance. But most people go through masters in finance programs of financial engineering at university, and they're taught by people who don't necessarily understand how the markets work. Or you yourself have mentioned, between us, we've mentioned the psychological side of things, and you really have to understand human nature really almost before you start doing the mathematics. And that's something people completely miss. They think the models explain everything, and most of these programs people go on, they're taught the mathematics, but they're not taught when things break down, why things break down, etc. So education is pretty bad, I think.
So tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
A time I failed, this may be a bit cheesy, it may not be strictly true, but it sounds quite good. There was a time, I must have been about 13, and there was a phase of, we were all playing all of card games and gambling, you know, just for pennies, really pennies, because this is in the early 1970s. And I remember one time making a bet with Billy Jones. He's Billy Jones, in my class, Billy Jones.
Oh, okay.
Another 13-year-old.
Gotcha.
And it was, I think it was about 7p, right? It was all the money I had in my pocket, 7p. And I lost this bet. And it was a stupid, stupid, stupid bet. But I made the bet and I lost it. And clearly, you can see me crying now as we speak. It's had an impact on my entire life. And I think it's made me very risk-averse.
We're all theoretically somewhat risk-averse, but you suffered a little... it's actually helpful. The worst thing in the world that can happen to someone is they walk into a casino and win money.
Yes, exactly.
Or their first time they start trading, they make money.
Yeah.
You're much better off experiencing loss up front.
No, I've got Billy Jones to thank.
That's right. That's right. Let's jump to our last and two favorite questions. These are the ones that seem to have the most amount of resonance with people. So if a recent college graduate or a millennial would come up to you and say, I'm interested in a career in quantitative finance, what sort of advice would you give them?
What do people usually say for this sort of thing then?
It ranges from I'm the wrong person to ask to, let me tell you these three things and never forget them, and everything in between.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you another point on the spectrum, which is, have children early.
Okay.
Postpone the career thing.
Really?
As much as you can. Do you have children?
No. So I'm a late bloomer.
I would say have children early, because most people talk about, they want to have this, get their career kick-started. Mm. And when they talk about their career, they're always talking about, I don't know, being a lawyer or a quant or something. It's not like they're curing cancer.
Right. It can wait.
It can wait.
Being a lawyer can wait.
And so it really upsets me when I see people who just good around children, but they've, anyway. So that would be it. Just wait a while and have children first.
And our last and final question, what do you know about quantitative finance today that you wish you knew 25 years ago?
One thing that I realized sort of halfway through that period would be that there's a lot of people have names attached to models, but usually those models, I don't know if I offend any friends of mine here, but usually those models
offend away.
How many people listen to this?
No, it's just the two of us.
They come up with a model, and usually it's a minor tweak to something, to some other model. And it's not necessarily a great model in any way, shape, or form. In
fact, it's a bad model tweaked to be something else.
To be even worse.
Okay. Yes. Not so, even to be better, to
no,
be worse.
No, usually it's tweaked to make it easier to use.
And if it's something, you did not know that 25 years ago?
I didn't realize that was sort of important. And I wonder if I knew that 25 years ago, would I have taken a different route? I really hope I wouldn't, because my route has always been to do whatever I think is fun. Mm-hmm. And that's why, if you look at my list of papers, there are all sorts of crazy things in that, in my list of papers. So this isn't really something I wish I knew I would have taken advantage of. I would like to think I knew it and I decided not to do it. It's Keynes again. I think it's Keynes. Uh-huh. He says, it is better to fail conventionally,
yes,
than to succeed unconventionally. And I very much succeeded unconventionally. So I don't know where I'm going with any of this.
but it's fascinating nonetheless. We have been speaking with Paul Wilmot, quantitative finance expert and author, his latest book. Paul, what's the name of your new book?
It's The Money Formula, Dodgy Finance, Pseudoscience, and How Mathematicians Took Over the Markets.
If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you could see any of the other 150 or so such conversations we've had. You can find us on Apple iTunes, Overcast, wherever fine podcasts are sold. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put this podcast together each week. Medina Parwana is my technical producer and audio engineer. Taylor Riggs is our booker/producer. Mike Batnick is our head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.